From West Virginia to South Dakota, Indiana to Florida, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Biden administration's five-year plan for offshore oil and gas leases would all but bring to a halt new production. Darren Bask from the Competitive Enterprise Institute is here with details. In an historic vote, the U.S. House of Representatives has ousted Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on what happens next. Congressional conservatives and those on the left all bought into low interest rate borrowing. Now that rates are up, it has become time to pay the price. Eric Boehm from Reason Magazine reports. And President Joe Biden's energy policies are focused on ending the use of fossil fuels, not bringing down prices for the consumer. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. From offshore drilling along the nation's coast to restricting drilling in Alaska, the Biden administration is waging a war on fossil fuels, in the process imperiling the nation's energy supply. Darren Bask is director of the Center for Energy and Environment at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He is here for a discussion. Darren, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Darren, the Biden administration has set forth a five-year plan, and this to deal with fossil fuels, particularly oil and gas leases. What is the administration proposing? Can you give us an overview of this five-year plan?
Earlier, the administration had proposed a five-year plan for offshore oil and gas lease sales. That would have meant anywhere from 0 to 11 lease sales, which was pretty scary that they'd actually have 0. So they've come up with what's called a proposed final program. This is basically their five-year plan that will include only 3 potential oil and gas lease sales. And the Department of Interior that handles this, in their press release, boasts that this is the fewest oil and gas lease sales in history. And just to provide some context, and this is from Reuters, since 1992, the fewest lease sales that have existed in a five-year plan has been 11. And most of the time you have 15 to 20. The Trump administration, in their five-year plan, they had proposed 47 lease sales. So basically, the Department of Interior is making it extremely difficult to have oil and gas lease sales in the outer continental shelf of the United States. And they are not just doing that that will hurt Americans, but they're actually boasting about the fact that they're restricting oil and gas for Americans.
When you talk about the offshore drilling here, Darren, are you talking mainly the Gulf of Mexico, or does this involve the Pacific and Atlantic coasts?
It can include all of it, but for them, their focus, their lease sales would be in the Gulf of Mexico.
So we have this restriction that the Biden administration wants to place on the drilling, offshore drilling of oil and gas. Darren, talk, if you will, a little bit about the current market. When it comes to oil, the price per barrel has been skyrocketing. The price of the pump is up. Give us a bit of background here as to the current state of the economy when it comes to the availability, the supply of fossil fuels.
I think the listeners will be well aware of the pain at the pump. And I think that's really the best way of kind of measuring it is to see what you're actually paying. So if you just look at the last 20 months, the regular retail gas prices have been $3.50 per gallon or more for 16 of those for 16 months. And so we've got it's not an aberration, these high prices. It's a consistently high price that we're seeing since the Biden administration has taken over. And the last time that the price for a regular retail gas was $3.50 or more was all the way back in 2014. And then when we look at some of the monthly gas prices and we compare it to past months, we're seeing record or near record prices. So, for example, in August of this year, it was the second highest August gas prices ever. The year before was the highest. So we're seeing some really kind of record prices when it comes to gas, and this is hurting all Americans, especially as a disproportionate impact on lower income households because they spend a greater share of their income on meeting basic needs like buying gas to drive their cars.
It also, of course, ripples through the entire supply chain because really everything we buy in some way, shape, or form is transported by truck or even a diesel locomotive. But just as a sheer look at the basics of economics here, Darren, when you have high prices, does it really make any sense to be restricting the supply not only now but for the foreseeable future?
Certainly, if you want to bring prices down, you would want to increase supply. It's basic economics. And what the Biden administration is doing is exactly the opposite. They're making it more difficult to increase supply. The lower the supply, the higher the prices. It certainly will drive up the prices. And we've talked about the five-year plan dealing with offshore oil and gas lease sales. But actually, over the last month, the Biden administration has kind of continued this kind of war on energy and oil and gas in particular. So earlier, not too long ago, they canceled 7 oil and gas lease sales in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that's referred to as ANWR. And then the Department of Interior, they published a proposed rule that would limit oil and gas lease sales in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. That's just an area, a big area in Alaska that's actually bigger than ANWR. And the agency, the Department of Interior, boasts, I mean, they're happy. I mean, they highlight this, that they're establishing a prohibition on any new leasing in 10.6 million acres of that area, which is more than 40% of that area. So this is an intentional game plan to stop the oil and gas from getting into the supply, basically, and to limit the supply. And ultimately, just we all know that's going to, as a result, inevitably drive up prices.
Well, and part of the game plan here is they want us to switch to driving electric vehicles. But even as we constrict the supply of oil and natural gas for home heating and other purposes here, Darren, and we see the demand for electric going up, are they, as a counterpart to this, as a companion to this, are they authorizing the construction of new electric power plants anywhere?
It's the exact opposite. They're making it more difficult. They have, EPA has proposed a rule dealing with power plants that will effectively help to kill off power plants, coal-fired especially, and potentially natural gas plants. There's an effort to shift towards renewable energy, which quite honestly is unreliable, and you can't expect to generate the electricity needed to meet the demand.
We will continue to keep an eye on the issue. One of the folks we talk to here periodically is Darren Bask, who is director of the Center for Energy and Environment, that at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And Darren, tell us a bit about CEI. Also, where can folks go on the web? You write extensively on this and other issues. Where can they find you?
You can find us at CEI.org, CEI.org. And the Competitive Enterprise Institute is a think tank. We do research, education, and public policy issues on a wide range of issues.
Darren Bask of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Darren, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson is at the offices of the Club for Growth, and it has been a very historic, busy week in Washington, D.C. We're going to parse through all of the details with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
For the first time in U.S. history, Speaker of the House has been ousted midterm. Want to tell us a bit of background as to how all that came about, and Speaker McCarthy is no longer Speaker.
Less than a year ago, in November 2022, we won the House majority, but we only won 222 seats. And so for modern history, it was one of the tightest majorities that we've ever had. And everybody remembers last January when Kevin McCarthy went 14 rounds before he was finally elected the Speaker of the House of Representatives. And he had to make all these promises. He had to make transformational reforms to the House alongside the House conservatives in order to get the votes. And in fact, there were 6 holdouts from January that voted present, but by them voting present, it actually gave him the number of votes necessary among all members present and voting in order to lock up the speakership. Fast forward to the debt limit agreement earlier this spring, we had a bill called Limit Save Grow, and it had nearly unanimous Republican support. The Republicans were all united, and as those debt limit negotiations continued, McCarthy ultimately cut what many people viewed to be a promise broken from the Speaker's agreement in that debt limit deal with Joe Biden as it pertained to spending levels and the way we were going to fight on the debt limit. And so it was the first real fracture I saw of House Republicans in their conference. And so throughout the summer, there were a lot of agreements on how they were going to adjudicate the individual appropriations bills. They obviously stalled on that. And I think that the culmination of all the disdain within the House Republican conference happened last week when McCarthy said, you know what, we can't find a way forward, we're going to do a 45-day clean CR, and that's that. That bill was effectively an extension of the Biden omnibus appropriations bill that nearly all House Republicans opposed. And when that bill was propounded in the House, there were 91 votes against the bill and about 120 Republicans supporting it. And so you really had a big, big division. Matt Gaetz led the motion to vacate. He signaled last weekend that he was going to make the motion. And earlier this week, we saw the motion made by Gaetz. And the next day, on Tuesday, October 3rd, the motion to vacate was there was a procedural motion first. It was a motion to table the motion to vacate, meaning it was a motion by Republicans to say, we're not going to do this right now. And the tabling motion was unsuccessful with 11 Republicans voting alongside the Democrats. Then they proceeded to about an hour of debate, 30 minutes for each side of the question. And one side was led by Matt Gaetz, and the other side was actually led by Kevin McCarthy's surrogates. He didn't actually speak in his own defense. And then the question was propounded before the House. And for the first time in our nation's history, Kevin McCarthy was vacated with 8 Republicans joining the Democrats.
An historic outcome to that vote. So now the House of Representatives is speakerless. There's a speaker pro tem, but essentially speakerless. The battle is now underway as to who will replace Kevin McCarthy. I guess the first question is, why would anybody want to do that, given the dynamics of play? But there are, in fact, a couple of candidates. So who is lining up?
Well, there's a lot of ambition in the House of Representatives, first of all. There's people that look in the mirror and they see the next United States Senator. There's people look in the mirror and they see a governor. There's people look in the mirror and they see a committee chairman. They see a position of Republican leadership. And so I don't think there's any lack of enthusiasm among the members to try and take the next step up in their own careers. In the instance of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, underneath the current rules, Patrick McHenry was designated by McCarthy to be the speaker pro tem. And what that means is he basically operates the office of the speaker in a ceremonial role, presiding over the next speaker's election. And we expect that to take place in the middle of next week. We know that there are at least 2 candidates that have publicly declared that they are running. The first one is House Majority Leader Steve Scalise. And the second one is House Judiciary Committee Chairman and former Chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, Jim Jordan. The two of them have been making phone calls. They've been meeting with powerful, influential leaders in the House Republican Conference. They've been meeting with the moderates. They've been meeting with the conservatives. They've been making their phone calls. They're trying to build out a campaign quickly to achieve 217 votes, assuming that all members of the House that are currently duly elected are able to be there in person and vote. There were obviously some absences earlier this week, and we know that there's 2 vacancies currently in the House of Representatives. So that brings the denominator down to 217, and in order to receive the majority, I think that getting to that number is going to be very challenging for both Scalise and Jim Jordan. There's talk of the two of them running on a slate together, and maybe Jordan can be the majority leader and Steve Scalise can be the speaker. That obviously is not a firm agreement by any stretch of the imagination. It could just be the Washington gossip that continues to sort of circle around the halls of the Capitol. And then you've also got another member of the House of Representatives that I think has been publicly reported that he's taking a look at it. I don't think he's released his letter, his dear colleague, to the House Republican Conference declaring that he's a candidate, but it's the Republican Study Committee Chairman Kevin Hern.
Certainly the wheels are turning under the Capitol Dome in Washington, and we're going to keep a close eye on that over the next week or two or three or four, however long it takes, with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If anybody wants to check out the Club for Growth, you can become a member for free. The website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Both the left and the right in Congress went on a spending spree when low interest rates made borrowing easier. But now interest rates are up, as is the national debt. We learn more from Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine.
Back in June of 2016, liberal commentator Matt Iglesias wrote at Vox that low interest rates meant governments all around the world, but especially in the United States, were practically obligated to borrow more money and run bigger deficits. The right course of action, he wrote, is really pretty obvious. If the international financial community wants to lend money this cheaply, governments should borrow money and put it to good use. We're now finding out the consequences of that approach, because we've spent the last 7 years or so doing basically exactly what Iglesias suggested, borrowing money at low interest rates and doing a lot of it. And now suddenly bond yields are jumping, and that means that big pile of national debt is a lot more expensive. The debt crisis is getting real, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Now, Iglesias was suggesting that governments borrow money and put it to good use because of those low interest rates. And he acknowledged in that piece that good use could mean a lot of different things depending on who was in charge. He personally favored higher infrastructure spending, but he also suggested that different governments might take on debt to finance things like broad-based tax cuts. The specifics could differ from place to place, but as long as there was cheap money to be had on the bond markets, loading up on debt was a means to a positive end. While it lasts, everyone could be enjoying a better life instead of pointless austerity, is how he concluded that piece. Now, I don't point this out to pick on Iglesias. He was, as he often does, kind of serve as a, you know, an avatar for the liberal political consensus on an important issue. With deficits falling and interest rates at all-time lows, borrowing seemed to make fiscal and monetary sense to the political left, which was at the time, this is 2016, remember, it was kind of frustrated by the political constraints that Republicans had placed on Barack Obama's second term. That's what Iglesias meant by that shot about pointless austerity. He's talking about the way Republicans had reined in Obama's borrowing and spending. Sure, the economy was doing great in the mid-2010s, but the argument here was that cheap borrowing meant it could be doing even better. Now, conservatives didn't necessarily share this rhetorical perspective in 2016, but soon enough they would reveal that they more or less agreed. On the campaign trail, of course, President Donald Trump unbelievably claimed that he was going to pay off the entire national debt within 8 years. Once in office, however, he just set about adding to it, with the gleeful agreement of Republicans in Congress, who hiked spending, cut taxes, and let additional borrowing fill that gap. During Trump's 4 years in office, the national debt grew by nearly $8 trillion, and you can only blame the pandemic, the emergency spending during the pandemic, for about the last $3 trillion or so of that total. In fact, then-Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said in 2020 that one of the reasons I feel comfortable with us spending all this money is because interest rates are very low, basically making the same argument that Iglesias was. And of course, since President Joe Biden took office, he's cranked the spending spigot open even wider and required even more borrowing to make ends meet. Now, when Iglesias wrote that column for Vox in 2020, the federal government owed about $19 trillion. Today, it owes more than $33 trillion, and we've just added another $2 trillion in the fiscal year that ended on September 30th. That was a year, by the way, with no national emergencies, and we were still $2 trillion in the red. In short, the federal government has followed Iglesias' advice. In fact, it might be more accurate to say that the federal government has gone along with what has clearly been a bipartisan consensus formed in the mid-2010s, that borrowing was cheap, debt was easy to afford, and deficit spending allowed everyone to enjoy a better life with none of those silly downsides of austerity. Unfortunately, the downsides have arrived. As I said at the top, the yields on U.S. Treasury bonds are now hitting levels not seen in decades. The 10-year Treasury bond is nearing 5%. The 20-year bond has already crossed that threshold, and some analysts expect higher yields to be coming in the near future. So why does that matter? I asked Mark Goldwyn that. He's the director of policy at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget this week, and he said that we took out a mortgage thinking we'd be paying 2%, but now we're paying 5%. That's the basic metaphor here. But unlike most mortgages, which have fixed interest rates, much of the U.S. government's debt is tied up in short-term bonds, which periodically roll over into new bonds with updated interest rates. It's a variable mortgage, if you will. And as a result, higher interest rates mean higher interest payments, and those funds come directly out of the federal budget, leaving less revenue for everything else that the government might aspire to do, whether that's funding welfare programs or buying more fighter jets. Interest payments on the debt are now the fastest growing part of the federal budget, and they will continue to be over the next three decades, according to the Congressional Budget Office's projections. In the short term, interest payments are set to triple by 2033, when they will cost an estimated $1.4 trillion. That's $1.4 trillion that comes out of taxpayers' wallets just to pay for stuff the government already did in the past. It gets you no new services, nothing new in the present. And that total will only grow higher if interest rates rise higher than the CBO expects, or if there's more borrowing done in the next few years. Among other things, the CBO warns that paying for all of this debt will slow economic growth and elevate the risk of a fiscal crisis. So in other words, all of that borrowing that we've done in the past decade or so that people could enjoy a quote-unquote better life, it didn't mean that at all. It meant that things could be temporarily better, but that the bill would eventually come due, as it always does. The consequences of this were just completely ignored by the political class. 2 months after Matt Iglesias argued for more borrowing in Vox, Paul Krugman made essentially the same point in the New York Times, writing that, quote, "These are the best of times for the world's most ravenous borrower, the United States of America." Yes, they were the best of times, and now comes the worst. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of the country's fiscal situation, the chaos unfolding this week in Congress, and everything else going on around this country of ours at Reason.com. And catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Biden administration is waging an irresponsible war on fossil fuels, thus setting the stage for energy shortages across the nation. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
One unfortunate sign of our polarized society is the debate over energy policy. On the left pole is the Biden administration, in near perfect harmony with the most extreme climate alarmists. Gasoline prices have climbed to nearly $8 a gallon in parts of Los Angeles, due mainly to the rise in oil prices. Harold Hamm, founder of Continental Resources, said that the Biden administration was more focused on, quote, putting us out of business than in bringing down high gas prices. Forbes magazine opined, "There is little room for nuance when it comes to President Biden's energy policy. The Biden administration appears to be working from one of two realities. The more charitable interpretation suggests administration officials are so overtaken with green ideology that they've lost the ability to recognize the economic, social, and environmental damage that their Green New Deal-like plans are causing. A less charitable take would suggest that they are comfortable relying on foreign competitors for energy that should be produced domestically." From its first days, the Biden administration has attacked and stifled America's energy production. Immediately after he was elected, Biden paused all oil and gas leasing on federal lands. He then killed the Keystone XL pipeline and the many thousands of jobs it supported. While the president's anti-energy policies stifled domestic production and raised prices on consumers, Biden again snubbed American energy producers by going on bended knee to OPEC and pleading for the oil cartel to boost production. It's possible that he is reliving the past and doesn't remember the fracking revolution has already happened and honestly believes America is still beholden to Middle Eastern oil. On the right pole are the climate change deniers like the Global Climate Intelligence Group that in August issued a report called World Climate Declaration, There Is No Climate Emergency, or Oklahoma Senator James Inhofe, who for years has called global warming or climate change, quote, the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. The Heartland Institute just this week said, quote, eradicating the world of crude oil usage without first having a replacement in mind would be immoral and evil, as extreme shortages of the products now manufactured from fossil fuels will result in billions of fatalities from diseases, malnutrition, and weather-related deaths, and could be a greater threat than climate change. This polarization tends to reduce a very important scientific debate to the binary world of politics. You're either on one side or the other. Very little attention is directed at analyzing the different levels of carbon emission by fuel type. Biden memorably made a campaign pledge to, quote, end fossil fuel. But he has no authority outside the United States to do so, rendering that absurd goal unattainable. What he really meant, but didn't have the integrity to say, was that he wants to end fossil fuel production in the United States. That policy is irrational because it's inherently counterproductive of his own policy goals. It reduces American energy independence, ships vast sums of American money to nations that are either unreliable allies or outright adversaries, and increases European dependence on Russian fossil fuels. It is not necessary to subscribe to Biden's climate alarmism to see the benefits of reducing carbon emissions. The single fastest and most effective means of achieving that goal is to encourage a massive transition to natural gas. Power plants, which are the largest source of carbon dioxide emissions in the United States, making up roughly a third of all domestic greenhouse gas emissions, can move from coal or petroleum to natural gas relatively easily. Natural gas is 45% lower in carbon emissions than coal and 37% lower than petroleum. Natural gas is abundant in the U.S. Liquefied natural gas can be exported to European gas users, most of whom are allies who would rather be dependent on us for its supply than on Russia. Next, some home heating and transportation users of petroleum could be transitioned to natural gas, further reducing emissions while improving rather than eroding our economy. The Biden energy policy is simply absurd from any perspective. Republican candidates for president should target it relentlessly and promote natural gas with unbridled pride and patriotism as an environmentally, economically, and diplomatically friendly solution. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WROK-AM in Rockford, Illinois, along with KXEX-AM, KGED-AM, and KQEQ-AM in Fresno, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.